Radio 4 Extra, on Tuesday at midday and at 7 in the evening.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Sudha Bushar concludes her reading of the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Boo's landmark work of life, death and hope in the slums of Mumbai. Today, while the effects of the global economic meltdown ripple throughout Anawadi, the slum itself comes under threat. Behind the beautiful forevers.
In November, the waste market in Freefall, the Tamil who owned the game shed tried to help the scavengers grasp why their trash was worth so little. The banks in America went in a loss. Then the big people went in a loss. Then the scrap market in the slum areas came down too. A kilo of empty water bottles, once worth 25 rupees, was now worth 10. This was how the global crisis was understood. The newspapers Sunil collected said that a lot of Americans were now living in their cars or in tents under bridges. The richest man in India, Mukesh Ambani, had also lost money, billions, although not enough to impede construction on his famed 27-story house in South Mumbai. Things will get better soon, Abdul told Sunil. Although the global markets were volatile, the behaviour of tourists could be predicted. They inundated Mumbai in the winter. Indians who lived abroad began arriving in November for the Diwali holiday. Europeans and Americans came in December. The Chinese and Japanese came soon after. And the hotels and airport boomed until January's end. One night in late November, Sunil was in the game shed when he heard a commotion outside. People were watching a news report on TV. Muslim terrorists from Pakistan had floated in rubber boats onto a Mumbai beach and were running loose in the city. The jihadis had taken over two luxury hotels, the Taj Hotel and the Oberoi, slaughtering workers and tourists. Before long, a photo of one of the terrorists filled the television screen. Black t-shirt, knapsack, running shoes. He looked like a college kid, except for the automatic weapon. Early the next morning, Sunil and his friend Sonu set off for work, only to discover that scavenging was out of the question. The airport perimeter was sealed and military commandos clustered on Airport Road. By the time the attack ended, 60 hours after it had begun, many Annawadians had accurately predicted the chain of economic consequences. A city in which terrorists killed foreign tourists in hotels was not a place other foreign tourists would want to spend their winter holidays. There would not be a peak season in Annawadi this winter. The airport would be quiet, the hotels empty. One January afternoon, Sunil took a bath in an abandoned pit at the concrete mixing plant. Pushing away the algae, he examined his reflection. He was a thief now. And Sonu, probably the most virtuous boy at Annawadi, said it showed in his face. Sonu wanted Sunil to renounce his new line of work, but unable to feed himself by scavenging, Sunil had to consider his airport terrain afresh, and locals who fenced stolen goods were glad to help him. For his first solo mission, the airport fire brigade was stripped of copper faucet valves. As construction workers prepared a cavernous airport car park, Sunil set to dismantling bits of it, screw by screw. Asha had conceived of 100 escape routes from Annawadi, but in the first months of 2009, those paths kept dead-ending. Her list of disappointments was long. The tedious, still unremunerative slumlording. The idea of her daughter Manju as insurance agent to the Mumbai elite. She was still living with a drunken husband in a cramped hut by a sewage lake. She had failed to crack the code of the wider city. While at home, many of her neighbours had started to loathe her, particularly after her attempt to capitalise on what Annawadians feared most, that in 2010 or 2011, the airport slums would start being razed. Plans were well underway. In place of 30-odd slums, there would be hotels, shopping malls, office complexes, perhaps a theme park. Private developers were granted rights to build on slumland only if they agreed to construct apartments for those slum dwellers who could prove they'd lived in their huts since 1995 or 2000, depending on the slum. In the previous 2 years, 122,000 huts had been demolished. Two-thirds of the affected families hadn't lived in their huts long enough to qualify for rehousing. So they had crowded into other slums or built new slums on the outskirts of the city. The general failure of Mumbai clearance efforts made the removing of the airport slums even more important. It would signify to the world that Indian leaders were making headway on their goal of a slum-free Mumbai. Asha identified an opening. The apartments promised to displaced airport slum dwellers would be tiny, but would have running water, which made them a valuable asset. Hence, over-city people had been buying up shacks in the slums and concocting legal papers to show that they were long-time Annawadi residents. Most of the speculators intended to use the rehabilitation flats as rental or investment properties. Anticipating commission, Asha arranged for a middle-aged hotel supplier to buy the hut of an illiterate young mother of three named Geeta. The fake papers showing that the businessman was a veteran slum dweller had come out nicely. Then Geeta began to have second thoughts at high volume. Asha had tricked her. Her children would be out on the pavement. The businessman sent a gang of drunken men to expedite Geeta's exit on a Sunday afternoon when all of Annawadi was on hand to watch. The men dragged the tiny flailing Geeta out into the slum lanes by her hair and dumped her belongings into the sewage lake. Bad visuals, damaging to the stature of a slum lord. Ever since that Sunday, the whispers of her neighbours had trailed Asha like jet streams. "She's become like an animal in her greed," said a Nepali woman. "Always she was sly, but now we know there is no one she won't hurt for money," said a Tamil woman. The idea that finally secured Asha's family's future was not her own. It belonged to an administrator at the Department of Education. His charge was to implement an ambitious central government program supported by foreign aid. Its aim was to make elementary education universal. The administrator's less public ambition was to divert federal money to himself. Discovering that Asha had a non-profit organization set up for her. Properly registered? Yes, properly. She was chosen to help him defraud the central government's most important effort to improve the lives of children. Government officials prepared documents attesting that for several years her non-profit had been running 24 kindergartens for poor children. The government would pay her 4.7 lakhs, or more than $10,000, for this fictitious work. From this windfall, Asha would write checks to a long list of names. What business was it of hers to ask who they were? A minor hitch occurred when the first installment of government money showed up in the bank account of the moribund non-profit. The checks to be disbursed required a co-signer, but the neighbour whom Asha had named long ago as the non-profit secretary was in a state. "What if we get caught?" She resisted signing the checks, so Asha fired her and appointed a more compliant secretary. The checks went out and the government officials got their cash. Triumphant, Asha felt confirmed in her suspicions. Becoming a success in the great rigged market of the overcity required less effort and intelligence than getting by day to day in the slums. "Of course it's corrupt," Asha told the deferential new secretary of the non-profit. "But is it my corruption? How can anyone say I am doing wrong when the big people did all the papers? When the big people say that it's right?" The new secretary nodded. But ever since she had co-signed the checks, her mouth had been slightly tight. How could she argue? Asha was her mother. Although Manju was troubled by this, she wasn't about to refuse the second-hand computer that soon came through the door. The children she'd taught in her slum school popped in regularly to contemplate its splendour. They still called her teacher, unwilling to believe that their education was over. But the schools Asha and Manju were pretending to run made their income derived from a real school unnecessary. Asha quit being slum boss. She was done with politics. She was a member of the Overcity now, the director of a charitable trust, a philanthropic organization with a city vendor number. At the end of May, the bulldozers of the airport authority began to move across the periphery of Annawadi. The beautiful Forever's wall came down, and the sewage lake that had brought dengue fever and malaria to the slum was filled in. As the rains began in June, the new judge presiding over the trial of Kekashan and her father Karam finally came to a conclusion. "There is nothing on record to show that the accused in any manner instigated the deceased to commit suicide. Thus, prosecution has miserably failed to establish guilt against accused beyond reasonable doubt. Move along now." Kekashan and her father flew. Now only Abdul's trial in juvenile court, the judgment on his honour, remained. In September 2009, the clerk said, "Next month it is likely to start." In October, the word was, "A 3 months' time, maybe." By the end of 2010, Abdul had concluded that a suspended state between guilt and innocence was his permanent condition. Early one morning, Abdul was perched on a black garbage bag when Sunil leaned in close. "Lend me 2 rupees for something to eat." Abdul reared back. "You haven't washed your mouth and your face. I get scared just looking at you." "Okay, okay," Sunil said, laughing. "Just got up. Early for a thief. Not doing that anymore." Garbage prices had been inching back up. Police beatings had been intensifying, and security guards at the airport had stripped him naked and shaved his head. Sunil had decided to return to scavenging. "Always I was thinking how to try to make my life nicer, more okay, and nothing got better," Sunil said. "So now I'm going to try to do it the other way. No thinking how to make anything better. Then who knows?" Abdul swatted him. "I lose my head listening to you." He felt old, sitting next to someone who still had ideas. When the slum got demolished, they'd probably never see each other again. Sunil wanted to start his life over, somewhere outside the city, where there were trees and flowers. But Abdul thought it likelier that Sunil would end up sleeping on the city pavement. "So what now?" asked Sunil after a minute. "What now? Go to work. Already you're late. What's going to be left on the ground at this hour?" "Okay, bye," said Sunil, jumping up and starting to run. Abdul watched him go. Weird and decent kid. He wished the boy luck, and half an hour later, Sunil would find it on a narrow ledge high above the Mithi River. Soon, the taxi drivers who littered this ledge with garbage would be pushed elsewhere as the new airport fulfilled its talismanic role, becoming an elegant gateway to one of the 21st century's most important world cities. But for now, 11 cans, 7 empty water bottles, and a wad of aluminium foil rested on a long spit of concrete, awaiting the first child with the courage to claim them.
Sudha Bhushar read Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Justine Willett. And after the weekend, we have Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education. It's the second volume of the author Brian Thompson's memoirs on growing up in the 1950s, charting his erratic journey towards adulthood, beginning with a waltz and an invitation to tea.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Susan Ray. And in this hour, more drama now in No Name. Wilkie Collins' novel about the stain of illegitimacy. Magdalene has been denied her inheritance after her parents died. She plans to recover it from her cousin by disguising herself as a lady called Susan. Not sure Susan's a sufficiently ladyish name, but good luck. And later, the novelist A.L. Kennedy is the guest in My Life in Five Books at 6:30. So now we continue No Name by Wilkie Collins. Disguise